behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I'm Ben Boland. Scott, Happy New Year.
Thank you, Ben, and Happy New Year to you, too.
Thank you,
sir. This is one of our first few shows of the new year, I guess, right? I mean, first official recording of the new year, maybe.
That's true. As we're here in How Stuff Works legendary audio studio, which has been getting some work done, too, I think.
Yeah, we've got new digs here, really. I mean, bigger studio with some soundproofing. You may hear some fire engines go by occasionally, but not too often, I hope, right?
Right. Hopefully they're driving and listening to the show as well.
Maybe.
So, yeah, as we're here in our continually improving studio for the first time this year, doing our first podcast of the year, Scott, you and I thought, what better subject to begin than
part two of Automotive First, right?
Yeah.
So we're beginning with like a catch-up, I suppose. Maybe that's the way to say it, right? Because I think we had a show that was called something like 10 Unlikely Autos That Changed Cars Forever, something like that, right?
Right.
Something similar to that. This is kind of like part two of that, a continuation that we wanted to get to because there's a lot more interesting stuff out there, I think, than what we covered. Now, I know the first one was interesting. I shouldn't say it that way, maybe.
But
there's a lot more interesting stuff out there, I think, that we can cover today. Like, I mean, we've got a wide, wide selection of things like two-piece car bodies, crash test dummies, the first gas station.
First car crash.
Yeah, this is automotive-related stuff, not necessarily the initial automotive trailblazers, the ones that, you know, changed something that everybody followed afterwards on every car after that. This is more like all-encompassing automotive things. So
world of auto.
Exactly.
So, yeah, for anyone who hasn't checked out our first episode on this, which was 10 Unlikely Autos That Shaped the Automotive World or something like that.
I don't know. Similar, yeah.
The pieces are there.
Just look back through the RSS feed.
Oh, yeah. Just look one entry down or up. But for anyone who hasn't checked that out, never fear. These episodes don't require listening to the first one. You should. It'll be more fun that way. But if there's something we don't mention in this episode and you haven't heard our first episode, check it out, because we may have touched on it.
And just in case someone didn't listen to that first one, one thing that we want to get out of the way here is that some of these, you can quibble with some of these, right? You can say you can say that, well, that's not the first, because I happen to know my great-great-grandfather was the first person to open a gas station in, wherever, Pennsylvania.
Right.
And a lot of these, you'll find, you know, these automotive first lists have a little bit of a fudge factor, I guess.
Let's call it wiggle room.
Yeah, wiggle room is maybe better. That, you know, it's not maybe this necessarily the first, but it's the first reported or first recorded or the first with an asterisk, because there's going to be some kind of qualifier that's thrown in there. Hopefully not a whole lot of that in this list, but we've got a lot to cover today.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you mentioned the part about qualifications and stories differing, because you know how it is, man. It's just like with a famous concert where this musician who later goes on to be world famous plays their first gig, right? In the basement of some coffee shop. And there were 15 people there, but then, you know, 20 years later, 400 people swear they were there. The stories differ.
Or they find out that the first gig was actually like at the public library.
Right.
Or something like that. You know, like it really wasn't the one in the basement. So anyways, we rarely trust these lists of firsts, but we're going to go ahead and read some of them. You know, these are kind of as history knows it.
Yes. Can I kick us off?
Please do.
All right. So the first joystick steering. This is from a great list compiled by Jalopnik User Suggestions. This was a joystick-controlled 1988 Saab 9000, and this came from, because, you know, Saab also made planes. They had these drive-by-wire planes, and the joystick controlled not just the steering, but also the brakes and the accelerator.
Very cool.
I think that's a horrible idea, though, to have one stick controlling those things.
But have you seen the short little video clip of that person driving that car?
Yeah, it looks amazing.
That looks like so much fun.
It does.
It truly looks like a video game. And this is one of those cars that was for sale, wasn't it?
Yes.
It was just last year, I believe, in January, I think.
Mm-hmm.
The Saab Museum.
Yes.
Sold all of its cars, right?
Nail on the head, Scott. Yeah, Saab put its entire museum up for sale. And if you were financially capable and maybe just nimble enough, quick-witted enough to jump on that, you could have found some amazing automobiles.
Yeah, it's pretty rare when a museum sells off its entire collection, and that was a good opportunity for someone there. Okay, how about this? The first mass-produced car. Now, I think a lot of people are going to say Model T, right?
Yeah.
Well, not the case, necessarily. The first mass-produced car, greater than 10 vehicles per week anyways,
okay,
came from Oldsmobile. The 1901 Curved-Dash Oldsmobile, or Curved-Dash Olds, was the first mass-produced car that, you know, again, that's 10 or more per week, so that's a very small production number. But
sure,
in 1901, that was really churning them out. Now, Ford gets credit because he gets credit for streamlining the production line. But it's something that Ransom Olds had already been working on long, long before that. It's just he didn't have it perfected like Ford did.
Right. And then, of course, I'm glad to qualify that, too, because there may be people saying, well, 10 a week is not mass production enough for me. You know, that doesn't count as
not
mass production.
Not modern-day terms, but in 1901, yeah.
Sure. I know, right?
It's pretty good.
Because they're still all being handmade. Mm-hmm. All right, so this is one from a list that you compiled here, Scott, that we had talked about off-air, which we actually originally wanted to do in our first episode.
Yeah, it was supposed to be the end of that one.
Yeah, and didn't have time. The first fully functioning automobile. Now, it says the 1885 Benz Patent Motorwagen.
Mm, okay.
I would wonder about the phrase fully functioning.
Fully functioning. I wonder. And, you know, the thing is, like, this whole question about what truly is an automobile, what's a car,
goes
back so far because, you know, I mean, I understand what you're saying about the patent wagon, and that gets the credit as the first car always.
Right.
1885, right? Now, but if you go back to the first car crash, now the first car crash in some instances, I've seen it listed as, get this, Ben, 1771. Now, do you know about that one?
Yeah. Yeah.
This is a crazy thing. I mean, the steam wagon?
Yeah, a 2.5-ton steam wagon built by Nicholas Joseph Cugnot, I guess. Yeah. C-U-G-N-O-T.
Close enough. He's French.
Yeah. This is where it gets kind of sticky because it's the first self-propelled vehicle to be involved in a crash.
Yeah, and it was unable to be steered, right? You couldn't steer this thing. It's a steam vehicle. It's like a wagon. You know, it's 2.5 tons?
Yes,
That's a very, very heavy thing. But, I mean, do you classify this unsteerable wagon as an automobile? I mean, really, because it's not necessarily a car. It's a self-propelled vehicle, like you said.
Hmm.
But you couldn't steer it, and it crashed into it crashed straight into a wall in 1771. And
what a surprise.
It had to have been going very, very slow. I mean, I don't think this is a high-speed crash by any means, but it probably took down the wall because of its weight.
Yeah.
And it just probably didn't stop. I bet it went straight through.
I'm sure.
But 1771 versus 1885, I mean, and they're calling that the first car crash in 1771. I don't know. I don't believe it, but 1885, I do think the Benz Patent Motor Wagon should get the credit for the first car.
Right, yeah, because as cool as it is to say that that 1771 crash is the first car crash, I don't know if we could really qualify that.
I don't know.
Car.
I guess you could look back to like some of Da Vinci's first working models and things,
right,
and say that was the first car.
Right.
Which a lot of people really think that was the first vehicle. And then, you know, I'm sure that some of those bumped into something, a tree or a rock or something like that. You know, he's testing these. Is that the first car crash? I don't know. That's why some of these things on this list kind of bug me just a little bit.
Yeah. Well, what do you think about the engine types? What do you think about the idea of the first straight engine being the 1903 Napier and Son? What do you think about that?
I'll buy that.
You buy that?
Yeah,
buy that for a dollar?
I mean, yeah, I'll buy that. And there's a lot of these that, you know, I think that you can trace these back and make sure that, you know, this is the first production V8. This is the first, 12 cylinder, the 16 cylinder, or the first type with, aluminum cylinder heads or the cycle engines, you know, things like that, whatever the category may be, the type of engine may be, I think you can go back and say that it was the one that was first used in a production car and you can date that. So now the first one built, that's a little tougher because then you go back to whoever's working on these things on their kitchen counter.
Oh, yeah.
In the garage, whatever. Uh-huh. They may have had a functioning model. They just didn't put it in a functioning vehicle.
Right. And they just kept it on that wood block.
Exactly. Yeah. But I mean, okay. So let's move on just a little bit. How about
sure,
that?
Well,
kind
yeah.
of, let's mix these up a bit.
Okay.
All right. So let's say, how about the first car theft? You want to talk about that?
First car theft?
Yeah.
I'd love to hear about the first car theft.
Paris, France, 1896, and that was apparently right after the Benz Pad motorway. So cars are invented, cars are stolen. That's where it goes, right?
Wow.
And I guess it was a baron's car that was stolen by a mechanic who took it out for pretty much just a joyride, really.
Uh-huh.
Because you know these brand new things, and the mechanic says, you know, I'm going to take this out for test drive without him knowing, without the baron knowing, which is probably not a good idea, but. Anyways, first car theft is credited to this baron, and I won't even attempt the last name, but his car was stolen by his mechanic. And then shortly thereafter, the first motoring fatality happened in August of 1896, mm-hmm. And it was at the Crystal Palace in London, and it was a woman by the name of Bridget Driscoll of Croydon, and apparently she was run over by a guy named Arthur Edsel at a speed of just 4 miles per hour, Ben. Now,
wow.
I don't know how somebody gets run over by a car that's only traveling 4 miles per hour. When we think about how fast cars travel today, I can understand somebody getting in the way.
Well, if we cast our minds back to the time, she probably wasn't dressed for running.
Probably not.
Could
have been a slip and fall thing. You know, could have slipped and fell right in front of the car. That could have happened.
Yeah, and as much as I would like to say she wouldn't have heard it coming, clearly she would have.
Definitely.
I don't know what to tell you, man. I do have the one of what's claimed to be the first charges for driving under the influence, or DWI.
When was that?
Apparently, the first arrest for driving under the influence happened in 1897.
My gosh. You know, the early days of the automobile, Ben, it's like everything happened all at once.
Everything happened in a week or something.
Did you say 1897?
Yeah. Okay. So a London cabbie crashed his electric taxi. Electric taxi, Scott, while he was found to be intoxicated, and he was arrested, and he was given a fine of, are you ready, 20 shillings.
I don't have any idea how much that translates
to. I know,
to,
I should have done the inflation
calculator.
I would
calculator. Think, who knows, but I would say that that's probably not a huge fine.
No, it's
but,
not. It's
but they,
not
but they didn't know what to charge him with, probably initially, right? I mean, that's the thing. Like, it wasn't really a thing yet until he had been arrested.
And I'm not too familiar with drinking history of London, but I'm going to go ahead and assume that he wasn't the only drunk cab driver.
I would assume that, too.
All right. So first, I've got some cool technology stuff, right?
Okay.
First mobile telephone call.
Oh, when was that?
1946.
46? No kidding.
True story.
Car phones in 1946.
Well, here we go.
Okay.
Car phone versus mobile telephone call. 1946, this team of some bright eggs at Bell Labs made the first mobile telephone call. They used a phone that they had just mounted under the dashboard of a car. So this was only able to make three calls. There were only three numbers it could call in the metro area where they did this experiment.
Oh, I see.
But it wasn't just the first car phone. It was de facto the first mobile phone ever.
1946.
Yeah.
Way early. All
so
right.
It was probably, you know, later in Vietnam and they had the backpack phones.
Oh, sure. They had to crank to get them going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I always felt sorry for that poor guy.
The field phones?
Yeah, you had to carry the field phone.
Yeah, that's
I guess that
big.
Was a Bell Lab thing in a car.
How about that? Let's move up. Well, actually, we're going to move back, believe it or not. The first supercharged car, 1921 Mercedes. Let's see. Then we got the first supercharged and turbocharged car, which I think is pretty interesting because it's a combination of the two technologies, and it was in a car that was produced for homologation purposes for Group B, which is really cool that we've talked
Whoa,
about in
yeah,
the past,
yeah.
right? So this was the 1985 Lancia Delta S4, the homologation special, which they produced 200 road cars total. You know, some of those were the race cars. But again, supercharged and turbocharged at the same time in 1985, first time ever.
So that's amazing. I don't know what to follow up with that.
Well, how about the first parking meter? I mean, see,
okay,
we're jumping all over.
Yeah, let's jump over.
All over the place. There's no rhyme or reason here, but Oklahoma City, USA claims to have the first parking meter, and it was installed in July of 1935. So pretty early on, they just needed to find a way to, you know, raise some revenue, and they thought parking would be a way, but they needed to do parking where they couldn't have somebody out there collecting money.
Yeah.
So this is a way to automatically do that. And of course, then the parking meter maids, I guess, would be the result of this. You know, people walking around handing out tickets for even more revenue generation, people that were avoiding paying the meter.
And later that Tuesday, the first parking meter theft occurred.
And lots of swearing.
Yeah, I bet. All right. First hybrid.
Okay.
Now this is a matter of contention, to say the least, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we have one list that says the first gas-electric hybrid was an 1899 loaner Porsche and was called Semper Vivus, built by a 25-year-old Ferdinand Porsche.
Mm-hmm. I think that's generally accepted as the first one.
Right. The reason I say that this can be contentious is if we're just talking about hybrids in general.
Oh.
So this is a gas-electric hybrid. People aren't arguing that. But then we have the first mass-produced hybrid car, which everybody knows this one, the Toyota Prius,
yeah.
Generally.
97, right?
Yeah.
1997.
Mm-hmm.
So long, long time in the future. So, what, man, 1899 to 1997. So we... 98 years between the two, really.
Yeah.
If you're talking about gas electric?
Yeah, gas electric.
Okay, so mass produced versus single production, right? I mean, that's the only difference there. Now, I'm gonna follow that up with one that you may be surprised by, Ben.
All right.
The first four fuel hybrid car. So, accepts four different types of fuel. I mean, bioethanol, hydromethane, gasoline, and LPG. You mm-hmm. know what vehicle this is? Just take a wild guess. Anything.
It is. Okay, why not? Well, let's play the game. I'll play your reindeer game, Scott. Is it a Ranchero?
No, it is not. It is a 2010 Monte Carlo Automobile Quadrifuel. Monte Carlo, Ben.
I know.
2010.
I know. I knew this. I thought I was going to get to make some more. My next guess was Canyonero.
Canyonero would be a good guess. I would accept that.
So this is great. If you guys haven't checked out our two-part episode on Monte Carlo, check those out. It's a labor of love.
Oh, I think, yeah, definitely. It was a long podcast, lots of history, yeah. Good history, and more than we had ever anticipated to come out of the Monte Carlo, right?
Yes,
I mean,
way more.
I don't know why we didn't think that, but we didn't think early on there would be a whole lot there. There mm-hmm. was more than you can imagine.
I thought it was a there and done thing for us. Now, you mentioned this in the opening. We should go ahead and talk about this. The first two-body car.
Oh, yeah, like a segmented
two
car,
section,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is so strange. It was like a pivot point, right?
Yeah, and it looks so fascinating that I would want to drive it just to experience the drive. I wouldn't want to own it.
I understand what you're saying. Yeah, it would be a tough one to drive. It would be a tough one to back up in, right? Back
yeah.
out in parking lots. Because the pivot point is immediately behind the engine. So you're sitting behind the pivot point. It's like it looks like you're pushing a small trailer.
Yes.
When in fact, that's the engine compartment.
Yeah, that's the 1958 Sir Vival. And then there was a great note by the Jalopnik author who wrote that. And he said, get it? Survival?
Ah, yeah. But you know what? This is even more strange because even though that front engine is there and you would think that would be what's driving the vehicle.
Right.
But it's pulling you along. It's rear wheel drive.
Which, first off, what? Yeah. Why? How?
Yeah, I mean, apparently it's got some kind of crazy swivel on the drive shaft, but it does have rear wheel drive, front engine, which is again separated by this pivot point. It's so strange. The vehicle is really, really strange, and that's the reason this type of thing never, took off.
I guess. And it was supposed to be, from what I understand, it was supposed to be a safety measure of sorts, and it was sold as one of the safest cars in the world.
I don't understand that. I mean, unless you can detach from the engine if it's on fire or something like
right.
that.
Right. It was unsuccessfully sold as one of the
And you can't, obviously you can't do that. How about, the first steering wheel, Ben?
First steering wheel.
Now you would think that this would be in 1896, right? Or 1895 when the first car came around. But remember they had those rudder steer type
while,
systems.
Yeah.
Like, with the one handle, it's so complicated looking.
Like the debutante.
Yeah, exactly. Strange thing. But it wasn't until 1900 that Packard came out with the steering wheel, the round steering wheel that we think of. And that is obviously, that's the way to go. I mean, that's I don't know how to put it, like the most concise way to steer a car. Maybe that's not the best way to say it. But
yeah, I see what you're saying. It's the most efficacious way.
Intuitive, I guess, maybe.
Intuitive is a good word.
Intuitive,
yeah.
I think. And that translates over into even boats and, any type of vehicle that has a steering wheel. I mean, it seems like a very intuitive way to direct a vehicle whatever way you want to go.
Hmm.
I mean, I know other cars still use joysticks, or other vehicles, I should say, like those
sure.
Bobcat, Skidster type, vehicles use
right.
two controls. And you mentioned the Saab with the joystick controls.
Mm-hmm.
Other ones have, I want to say that there was like a car that had a single joystick controller at one point.
Yes. Are you talking more modern cars? Are you talking like the rudder design?
Well, it's a concept car from maybe the 1980s
oh, yeah.
or something like that.
Yeah, you're right. There's more than one.
Yeah, I think so. But anyways, all these things weren't really standardized until, the early part of the 1900s and the steering wheel from Packard just happened to be one of the items that went along with all that.
Packard also, the first U.S. car to offer AC systems in 1939.
1939. That's pretty early, you would think, for AC systems. Now, I've heard, this is strange.
Okay.
I heard that before that time, you could pull up to a fueling station, a gas station, and you would crack the window, and they would hook up this big tube to the window, and it would cool off the interior of your car as you fueled up. And then you would roll up the window, and whatever was inside the car would stay inside the car for as long as it could, you know, and make sure it's hot. But it would stay cool just for that amount of time, you know, as you're driving away. But it was a nice service that these full service stations would provide.
Now that's true because we looked at that, didn't you? Have a picture of that that you showed me
somewhere a long time ago. Yeah. I mean, it was way in our past. It was kind of like a strange invention type thing,
but
it was prior to, you know, automotive AC systems that were mobile that would stay with the vehicle. This was like a system that was permanent at the fuel stations, and you would just hook up to them, you know, when you came in for gas. It was very, very strange, weird thing.
Oh, I've got some first that I just want to go down in a quick laundry list.
All right, let's do it.
And I want to hear if you believe them or not. So 1915, Packard creates a handbrake on the driver's left side. First U.S. car to do that.
Okay.
Studebaker, first U.S. car to offer windshield washers, 1937. Power brakes came around 1933, but I don't have a specific manufacturer for that. Buick, apparently. First power windows, 1950.
That's the Y job, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Harley Earl's car. I think we mentioned that one in the last podcast, right?
Yes.
Very, very cool. That's a neat invention. Of course, one that stuck around. Everybody's got power windows now. Mm. Seems like it anyways.
Yeah. I think most people either have power windows or purposely own an older car, at least in the States. All right. The first drive across America, you know this one, Scott. It's an oldie but a goodie.
Oh, yeah. That's got to be the Horatio Jackson, right?
Yes, sir.
Dr. Horatio Jackson.
That's a doctor. And, of course, their dog. That we have an entire podcast about that. We don't have to say anything else other than look up our episode, World's First Road Trip.
Sure. Bud the Dog and his doggles. Remember those? Mm-hmm.
Oh, the first U.S. cross-country road trip. Sorry. Because, remember, the first road trip is in Germany, right?
Sure, that was, who was that?
That was his wife, the
Mercedes inventor's wife.
Yeah.
Can't come up with the name right off the top of my head, but, man, how about this, Ben?
Right.
Airbags. Airbags. Now, you would think that airbags are a relatively new invention, right? They haven't been around all that long.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess recent past, maybe. I mean, not as far back as they really go. They go all the way back to 1974.
40 years officially
as
of this year.
General Motors came out with airbags in 1974. And, you know, this is one of those things, again, where it's like, you know, the first airbags offered on a regular production vehicle, and that was the option on the 1974 model, right?
Yeah.
And they had front airbags. It was on Cadillacs, Buicks, Oldsmobiles. And I think an Electra was another vehicle that they came out on. But the other first for airbags came from the 1987 Porsche 944 Turbo, and then had the first dual airbags. Mm-hmm. And then the 1994 Volvo 850, which was the first car with side impact airbags. So, you know, they kind of advance along the way, and you'll find that, you know, there's also first for, I think it's automotive seatbelt airbags. Have you ever seen those?
Oh, yeah.
And then
there's
exterior airbags for pedestrian safety, which is another odd thing that's kind of coming around now. I think there's cars that actually have those now.
Really?
Yeah. There's some,
I thought it was going to be a flash in the pan.
Well, some strange exterior pedestrian safety stuff that, you know, we haven't really talked about too much in depth.
That's a teaser for an upcoming thing.
What about heated seats?
What about heated seats?
Yeah, do you know heated seats? These go back way farther than I thought, because I thought these were like a late 1990s, early 2000s invention.
Yeah, but Cadillac, right?
Yeah. How far back?
See, okay, I don't know. I just put Cadillac heated seats.
Oh, I'll tell you what, Ben. It goes back way far. 1966.
66?
66, yeah. And the thing is, I think that they were just kind of continually on. I think they were heated all the time. They weren't really switched on and off, I think, until later. But it was an option on the 75 series models of Cadillacs in 1966. And the first to have, like, the first ventilated seats, I guess. Ventilated front passenger seats were the Saab 9.5 in 1998. So, you know, it jumps way up in time, but, and I know Saab, you know, kind of gets this, this reputation for having the first seats in 1971 that were heated, but I think that those were the ones that were able to be switched on and off. Cadillac just had them on, I believe, permanently. I think that's the way it goes.
With that, Sorry, Sky, I forgot for a second. I was getting so into all these first.
I know. It gets confusing, you know, with the different makes and models and the qualifiers and everything.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you what, the first nav system, you would think that is, again, you would think that's in late 90s, early 2000s type thing, right? Because, you know, we tend to think of it as going along with GPS, right?
Right. And then going along with mobile technology in general.
And that really, and GPS started happening in the late 80s, and I want to mention that in just a moment, but the first navigation system that really isn't a GPS system that looks like it, though, when you see a picture of this thing, it's called the Honda Electrogyrocator.
Yeah, and it's, I feel like it's so much more MacGyver level clever than an orthodox GPS.
It really is. I mean, the way it works is it has a gas bubble gyroscope, and it detects movement and has this mechanical connection to the transmission, and it senses the distance and the speed that you travel mm-hmm. in order to figure out where you are on this set of maps. These like these overlay maps that are inside the unit, and it's really crazy. It almost looks like something out of a boat, like a fish finder almost. Is what it reminds
does.
Me.
That's
of.
Really good. Yeah, because it's not a it's not a great LCD display at all.
No, it's not like an 8-inch HD screen that
right.
you know, we find in new cars or anything. It's this almost a primitive looking type thing, but it's really cool. It looks a lot like the made up type inventions that they would have in like a Bond car.
Yes.
Or a Green Hornet invention.
Yeah.
Something like that, right? It has a kind of a funny look to it, but it's a real functioning thing, and it's called the Electrogyrocator. It's from 1981.
Yeah.
So it goes way back, and that's prior to GPS or global positioning satellites.
Mm-hmm.
And the first car that had a true GPS satellite navigation system was the 1986 Toyota Soarer GT Limited. And, I guess, man, that was in 1986. That's only 5 years later.
Right.
So the technology caught up pretty quick.
Which makes me a little sad because I was impressed by by everything except the name of the gyrocator.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about it, it is impressing that they could manage to make an entirely mechanical device. That's what baffles me about it.
Yeah. Well, you'd have to have very specific maps for the area that you're going to be traveling in, right? Because you can't
go. That is a drawback.
You couldn't drive off the map you could drive off the map, I guess.
But then it would just tell you what direction you were going and how long you've been doing that.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that's right. So that would be handy as well.
But we've got another one that probably dates back a little bit further than people think. Scott, first retracting hardtop, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And this one goes way back to 1957 and Ford with the Ford Fairlane 500. And man, this is a big top on this thing, Ben. It's a fully retractable hard top that breaks in a segment. It looks like it breaks right above the driver. And then the whole thing, the whole shebang goes right into the trunk, way into the trunk. So the trunk, which is enormous, by the way, has zero luggage capacity when this thing is folded away.
Right. A slight disadvantage of the engineering, but still very clever, innovation and would only work on a car the size of the Skyliner.
And prior to that point, because the sheer mechanics of the thing, in 1957, you got to imagine the size of the motors that ran this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the technology isn't like, the micro switches of today. Have we talked about retractable hardtops in modern day retractable hardtops?
We've talked to, I don't know if it was been on air. I think maybe we were talking about the German company. We did. We talked about the German company that was known purely for innovating convertibles and hardtops.
Okay, very good. Well, in 1996, Mitsubishi came out with the first, I guess what they call the first modern day retractable hardtop. And that was in the 3000 GT Spider. And it had, used an ASC McLaren design two piece folding roof. And you'll find that almost all of the retractable hardtops of today, like you look at the Volkswagens that do it, you look at the Chryslers that do it, some of the popular modern retractable hardtops, they all have a very, very similar design. They all come from a similar company or the same company maybe even. And I think ASC has a lot to do with that still.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have to look up who the manufacturer is who does that again. But very, very similar for every model, every make, it seems like.
I'm skipping around. First four-wheel drive performance car, 1966, Scott, the Jensen FF.
Now, that surprised me completely, because I don't think of performance vehicles in four-wheel drive other than the Audi
Quattro.
The Audi Quattro, and that was in 1981.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it's another 15 years.
Yeah, and it it was described as essentially an Interceptor Mark III with 5 inches added to the wheelbase and a transfer case.
Yeah, and you know what? I just got my my head wrapped around the Audi Quattro as being the first one. I've always assumed that was the first one.
I did too.
But looking at the Jensen FF, and I mean, I'd have to see it in action, I guess, to see what you know what it does really. But I mean, if they call it a performance car, you know, it's going to be a performance car. Now, also, you know, it's not four-wheel drive that we're talking about. We're just talking about, like, something that's off-road, rather.
Right.
We're talking about something that is a performance-enhanced system. So, you know, that's the qualifier there on that one, is that the Jensen apparently was a performance vehicle versus a car that could also go off-road. You know, like
right.
Some of the tougher, you know, higher-up vehicles that, you know, were more suited to camping and climbing mountains or whatever. Mm-hmm. And there were a few of those around.
Yeah, that is true. It sounds a little bit counterintuitive to think, you know, four-wheel drive on a performance car, why? But it does enhance the abilities of the car.
Yeah, and there were cars that could, you know, do the four-wheel drive thing. Like Subaru had cars out that, you know, were a clunky system, I think is how they described the system. You know,
right.
You'd have to stop and then, you know, activate, you know, you'd have to pull up different levers and shift in different manners. And, you know, it's more like shifting into like four-wheel high or four-wheel low in an older Jeep.
Yeah.
Now that's the process that I would think
Pretty
of.
Good call, man.
Yeah, something similar to that, right? Now, here's one that I think, I've just got a few more, really.
Okay.
I've got hundreds more, but I think I'm just going to cover just a few more. And, one of them I want to talk about is the keyless entry, or remote keyless entry, rather.
Mm.
And mm-hmm. You would think that, you know, this has been around, again, I would guess maybe 10, 12 years, something like that at the most.
Oh,
because it seems like most cars don't have that, right? I mean, or didn't have that until that point.
Mm-hmm.
But how far does this one go back, Ben?
This one goes back to 1982 on the Renault Fuego.
Yeah, 82.
Yeah.
And I would never, ever have guessed that the Renault Fuego was the one that came out with the first remote keyless entry.
Yeah,
I mean, it's an unlikely source.
Well, if you think about the technology and the way it works, it's sort of like the invention of the first remote control. It's not as crazy or out of reach as it sounds. Mm-hmm. So it's just a wireless transmitter. Those existed already.
They just happened to be the first to throw it into an automobile in that application.
Stroke of genius.
Yeah, I guess so. But and this system, I mean, it looks very much unchanged. I mean, if you look at the remote, it looks very similar to what you'd find
fob.
Today.
Yeah.
Exactly. So you think about the Fuego, you think about the Renault Alliance from that day, mm-hmm. You know, these French cars, these small Renault French cars. And you would never think that something innovative or crazy came out of that design. But in fact, there was something, and it was this keyless entry. Strange turn of events, I guess, in that one.
Now, this is one that will be exciting for a lot of our listeners. First turbocharged production car, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And that one, I'm surprised that it took this long, really.
See, this is one of the only things on the list where you say, I'm surprised it took that long.
Yeah, because turbo had been around for a while. I'll have to look up the date when turbo first came around. But the first turbo production car wasn't until 1962. And it was the Oldsmobile F85 Jetfire.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's a great idea, of course. I mean, the first, I guess, turbo, now that I think about it, turbo has been around since something like 1905.
Yeah, that's the first patent, right?
Yeah, first patent wasn't the first application, really. I mean, they had the idea, had it all sketched out, you know, the way that it would work. I don't think that it was actually thrown into a production car until 1962.
Right, and a lot of people will say that, will cite the Monza, right, as the Chevrolet Corvair.
Mm-hmm.
Turbocharged Chevrolet Corvair as the first one in the game. But true story, a major friend's, the Oldsmobile F85, beat the Monza by just a couple months.
Yeah, and one note that, you know, on this list that we're kind of reading over here, GM was making a rear-engine, turbocharged, air-cooled flat-six car 12 years prior to when Porsche was making its 911 Turbo. So a lot of people credit Porsche with that type of engine setup and that layout, you know, with the 911, but this is actually, you know, 12 years prior to that. So go back to 1962 and you think, you know, in 1974 Porsche was doing this and how, you know, dramatic and innovative that was.
Uh-huh.
Well, we can go back to Oldsmobile in 1962 and they're doing the same thing.
Scott, I just have, I don't know, I guess it's getting time for us to wrap up, which is a little sad because we have so much stuff we're not going to get to.
I mean, I literally have hundreds of these things. I mean, seatbelts, electric starters, I mean, stuff that you would call, I guess, just other You know, some really interesting ones. And I hope maybe we can drag some of these out later. And, you know, the good thing is that a lot of these relate to the topics that we're talking about. So if any of these, you know, come up in our memory, I guess, as we're talking about other vehicles throughout the year, throughout 2014, we'll be able to go back to this list of firsts maybe and include some of those little facts. How about that?
Okay. You know what? I will make that bargain because I'm frantically going through my notes for the first crash test dummies and other things of interest.
Okay, that's one I think we do need to include. How about we do that and we'll end it with that. How about that?
All right. Okay. So Wayne State University in Detroit starts using crash test dummies in 1930.
Yeah.
In the 30s.
Early on. But the strange thing about this is, and that's not maybe, you know, terribly unusual, right? You would think, well, of course they're using crash test dummies, right?
Safe.
These are live humans. These are guys that just volunteered and said, we want to find out how how crashes affect the human body. We're going to volunteer for these studies. And there are people that volunteer, I know, for a lot of different medical studies and things like that.
Yeah, even today.
I mean, to volunteer yourself to be smashed into a wall or have another car crash into you, terribly dangerous. And think about cars in the 1930s.
Right. And the guy who was heading up a lot of this research, Lawrence Patrick, you know, if he couldn't get volunteers or if he felt it was unethical or unsafe, he experimented on himself, which is why I think to this day, doesn't he hold the record for the most car accidents?
Something like that. Yeah, he's definitely up there. And another twist to this whole thing. And
Spoiler alert. You know
the big twist, right?
Yeah.
They often use cadavers. So corpses were used to test automobiles, you know, way back when, you know, they drop them from elevator shafts. They would see how impact, because they couldn't do some of the impacts to head. The head region.
Right. Things that would clearly harm a living person.
Exactly. Yeah. They had to use cadavers and then base their studies, you know, on what they would find afterwards. And I guess the dirty little secret has been they still do that today.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think a lot of people probably knew that, but,
I don't think so, Scott.
Maybe.
A lot of people don't know that.
And it's still done. They don't talk about it. They don't publicize it.
Right.
But cadavers, corpses are still done today. I mean, these are bodies that are, you know, willed to science, you know, that say we'd like to be used for experimentation. I don't know how all that works out. We'll have to figure that out. But,
right.
All the big automakers still do it because that is the one way to test how a real life human, well, a real dead human, reacts in a true accident.
Right. And there are a lot of technological innovations being made with crash test dummies or, you know, with other kind of mannequin things for everything from CPR to, you know, even simulating heart attack. But the problem is that when it comes to the body entire, you can't beat the real thing.
Exactly. And Ben, you got to think about it this way too. Those corpses have saved countless lives. I mean, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of lives in you know, what they've proven through all this testing. So, you know, they're very, very important.
Yes. And with this unexpected twist, I didn't know we were going to end up on that one. It's a ghoulish twist for the new year. Mm-hmm. Do you want to close out with some listener mail?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, Scott. So Johnny writes to us. Johnny is a newer listener, and he says some very nice things about our show. Thank you, Johnny, but we'll skip to the good stuff. He says, I consider myself a car guy. I've had many fun cars, one of which was a 1996 Trans Am and another being a 1991 MR2 Turbo. Unfortunately, says Johnny, a family of four lifestyle caused me to put my impractical sports car days in the rearview mirror of my more family-oriented Toyota 4Runner.
Oh.
At least for the time being, he says. When I get the funds together, I'd like to get a fun and sporty third car, and I was wondering if you have ever considered doing a podcast on some of the affordable mid-engine rear-wheel drive cars like the Toyota MR2, the Pontiac Fiero, the Porsche Boxster, etc. He said, I like the podcast on the Miata. However, I am 6'3", and I've never really fit well into one.
You know what? I think he just named all of the semi-affordable mid-engine rear-wheel drive cars.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, that's a great idea. I think that's Johnny, that's a really good idea. Definitely sporty, definitely fun to drive. Mid-engine cars are so much fun.
Oh, yeah.
And again, lots of room for, you know, someone with long legs, apparently. Johnny must be tall.
Yeah.
What did he say? 6'2", 6'3", something
6'3",
like that?
6'3", yeah.
6'3", that's pretty tall.
Which is funny, because one of my close friends in college, a guy named Nathan, is probably about around 6'3", a little over 6'. and he drove an MR2. I mean, we called it Mr. 2, mm-hmm. and he had to get rid of it. It was now Albatross around his neck because he got parking tickets all the time.
Oh, okay. That was the problem? But, you know, you would think that it would be a speeding issue or something like that. I mean, in a car like that, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, he was a pretty good driver, I guess. And he's still alive. He's a pretty good driver. Mm-hmm. But he just couldn't handle... He would still get tickets whenever he was a few miles over.
Yeah.
And he would park... I don't know. Maybe he just parked illegally everywhere.
What a shame to have to get rid of that car, though, because of that. Because, man, those are fantastic cars. The first generation, the later ones, the kind of smoothed out version. I don't know what Gen 2, Gen 3, I don't know which it is. I'll have to look it up. But beautiful cars. They were a lot of fun.
Yeah. So, Johnny, that sounds like a great suggestion. Obviously, Scott and I are into it. While we go out to look at some more upcoming episodes, we'd love to hear from you. Drop by our website, carstuffshow.com. Let us know what you think. You can check out videos, blogs, podcasts, and more. And feel free to hit us up on Facebook or Twitter, where we are Carstuff, HSW. Or, you know what? You can always write to us directly. Our email address is...
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.